Welcome to another NPR Music Listening Party. I'm Tom Huizenga. You know, all week we've been exploring J.S. Bach's Goldberg Variations from many points of view, and in just a few moments, the point of view comes from pianist Glenn Gould. We'll be listening to his complete 1955 recordings of the Goldbergs. But first, let me introduce my colleague and co-host of NPR's classical music blog, Deceptive Cadence, Anastasia Silkus.
What a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Also, we have some distinguished guests today. I'd like to introduce Anne Majette, the classical music critic of the Washington Post. Anne, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tim Page is joining us from the Annenberg School at USC, where he is professor of journalism and music. Tim, thanks so much for being here.
It's great to be here.
And you, listening, please join in the conversation in the chat room on this page. Feel free to jot down questions for Tim and Anne. And if you're tweeting about this live listening party, the hashtag is NPR Goldberg. You know, the Goldberg Variations is a huge suite of 30 keyboard variations, bookended by a very lovely aria, which we're just listening to. Bach wrote it for a dual manual harpsichord around 1741 or so. There were a couple of keyboardists who took up this piece in the early 20th century, but I think it's probably safe to say that no one before or since Glenn Gould's 1955 recording has made such an impression with the music. Tim Page, you have spent quite a bit of time thinking and writing about this 1955 recording and Glenn Gould, whom you eventually befriended. Not that many people, even classical fans, I think, knew much about Bach's Goldberg Variations in 1955, and yet this recording became a runaway bestseller. And who could have guessed?
It was really an unusual first recording, major recording for a young man from Canada to make, or for anyone to make at that point. It was considered kind of a recondite and rather difficult and austere piece of music that was of more interest to scholars than the general public. But Glenn Gould insisted that this would be his first record, and of course it turned into a huge hit. It's never been out of print, even for a moment, since 1955, which was Eisenhower's first term in office.
And do you think it was somewhat a risky pick for both Gould and the record company at the time?
Absolutely, it was risky. I mean, you could say that any unknown pianist recording a great big, less performed work is a risky venture.
What do you think, Tim, makes it the icon that it has become today? You know, never out of print. Anytime you talk about the Goldberg Variations with anybody that knows Bach's music, Glenn Gould's name is bound to come up in this recording.
Yeah, well, it was very exciting. There were very fast tempos. It rather than seem remotely musty, it kind of strutted around. It was highly romantic at moments. It was just one of those recordings which just opens your eyes to something. He treated it as music rather than a brilliant set of variations. And, of course, it is a brilliant set of variations from and can be analyzed from many different technical sides. But the fact of the matter is he made it music, and he made it music that a lot of people suddenly discovered, somewhat to their amazement, that they really wanted to hear and hear again.
And remember, if you're in the chat room, you have time to jot down a question for Tim or Anne. We'll be answering as many as we can. We'll be listening to the aria and the first 15 variations. There's a kind of convenient break after variation 15. And what are a few of the things we should be listening for as we let the music roll here in just a few minutes?
Well, Gould is so brilliant at bringing out the counterpoint. Although he's playing it on a piano, there's this kind of transparency and clarity in the way he gets the voices talking to each other. That's one of the hallmarks of this recording. And part of its brilliance. I think there's a tendency now when people are playing these pieces on the piano to make them even more pianistic in a way. And Gould gets the piano out of the way in a sense. The music the voices are talking to each other without, although as Tim said, it's quite a romantic rendering in many ways. It's not romantic as recordings of the early 21st century have been romantic, where it becomes sort of like Simone Dinnerstein, which is a much more, to my ear, romantic reading
right.
than Glenn Gould's.
Right.
It almost feels to me in some ways as though he anticipated a lot of the early music sort of in the 1955 recording, that sort of fleetness that we came to cherish in a lot of ways.
Right, and of course, Glenn Gould does not play any of the repeated music and the Goldberg Variations in 1955, and that's why they clock in at a convenient 38 minutes or so, easily fitted onto two sides of an LP. So, again, if you have questions for Tim and Anne, join in the chat room. I'm Tom Heisinger, it's NPR Music, and let's hear it, the first half of Bach's Goldberg Variations, recorded by Glenn Gould in 1955. We start out with the aria and the first 15 variations. You're listening to an NPR Music Live listening party. We've heard the first half of Bach's Goldberg Variations and the legendary 1955 recording by Glenn Gould. I'm Tom Heisinger here with Anastasia Silkus and Majette, classical music critic of the Washington Post, and Tim Page, author, music professor, and a former confidant of Glenn Gould's. First off, Anne, what are your reactions after just hearing that first half again?
Well, it certainly flies by, doesn't it? The tempi are quick. There aren't the repeats. What I love about this recording is the kind of offhandedness, even the insouciance of it, playing fiendishly complicated music with this sort of antic spirit of great fun. And yet the ornaments particularly are so clean and so elegant. We were talking before about the making a recording at that time. It strikes me that, of course, to make any recording at that time was different. There weren't as many recordings. You can, in a way, I sense that he sets out to make this recording without the weight of the recorded legacy on his shoulders that people have today. Those notes have not been fondled as much by other hands as they have been for somebody playing it now.
Tim, what about you after hearing that first half?
Well, for me, I usually play the 1981 version or possibly the Salzburg version from 1959, which is a very beautiful live performance, which I suggest that maybe some of our listeners check out. It's not that I don't think this is a spectacular performance. It is. But I find the wisdom that Gould brought to some later ones even more compelling for me in this particular work. That said, what I love about this is that it is a very young person's Bach. It's a 22-year-old genius suddenly set loose to fly as high as he can, and he goes into the studio, and I've listened to all the outtakes of this. When we put together the Estate of Wonder set a few years ago, we listened to all the outtakes, and it's amazing because clearly, Columbia didn't think they were going to have a hit, and they didn't seem to think too much of this recording because they gave him a slightly out-of-tune piano. You can barely hear it on this recording, but you can hear it very much so on a lot of the outtakes. So, and it was apparently a very, very hot time in Manhattan. And I don't know, it just sort of brings me back to that interesting time before Glenn Gould was a legend. At this point, he was a kid just proving himself, and boy, did he prove himself with this record.
It's so digital. I mean, you can't help but see fingers, you know, flying over the keyboard. There is something still very exciting about it. Anastasia Silkus, my cohort in Deceptive Cadences, with us here too, and you've been keeping tabs on the chat room. There are a lot of people talking about Glenn Gould in the chat room, and I'm sure we have some questions.
Yeah, and funnily enough, Salzburg's already come up in the discussion, so maybe we should start there. A question from Tim Page from someone named S. Stratford: did Gould ever share with you how he felt about that 59 performance in Salzburg? It's unfortunate that he didn't like to perform the work live, because to me, that live recording was his best.
Well, it's really interesting about Glenn, in that for somebody who really didn't like to perform live very much at all, a lot of his live performances are among his best. A lot of the ones preserved in that big CBC set of his films, a marvelous Mozart Concerto No. 24 that he recorded in Stockholm and a number of other live performances. He was a spectacularly good live performer. And I think he was actually sometimes more inspired, even though he would argue with me about this to the death, by having an audience around. But he did not like live performances. And I don't think we ever talked about the Salzburg performance. Of course, you have to remember, I hadn't heard the Salzburg performance when he was still living. And it's a good chance that he hadn't heard the Salzburg performance, because I don't remember where the tape was made, but or where it was for all those years. But it was one of the many tapes recordings that came out after his death.
Tim, you interviewed Glenn Gould and talked to him many times, and actually not long before his death, before the second his second recording of the Goldbergs came out in 1982. And it's curious that Gould, listening back to his old 1955 version, like we're all doing today here, he didn't really like it that much. At least that's what he told you.
I wonder if he would have changed his mind as he grew older. He'd become a very, very different pianist by the time he re-recorded it, when he was 48 or 49, and nobody really thought he'd be dead in only a year. But, you know, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, I think this happens with a lot of artists, that you look back at your earlier self and you go, what the heck was I doing? If he had lived on to be 80, as he would have turned this year on September 25th, I have a feeling he might have a more charitable approach to it, because it's a very young man's Bach, and from a period of middle age, especially when he did the much more sober and calculated version in 1981, I can see why he was reacting against it. But who knows? He might well have come to embrace this again. Certainly, it's one of his greatest and most totemic recordings.
I can't help but want to just play just a little clip of that interview with you and Glenn Gould from 1982. So let's give a listen to it. It's Glenn being pretty critical of himself.
I want to play just a few bars of this variation in both versions.
We really have to hear the early one, eh?
Oh, I think we must. The contrast is, shall we say, striking.
That it is.
Now, this is the 1955 version.
Which sounds remarkably like a Chopin nocturne, doesn't it?
No. I think on its own terms, though, Glenn, that this is really lovely playing.
Well, yeah, it's okay, I guess, but there's a lot of piano playing going on there, and I mean that as the most disparaging comment possible. You know, the line is being pulled every which way. There are cute little dynamic dips and tempo shifts, like that one, things that pass for expressive fervor in your average conservatory, I guess.
Do you really despise this version?
No, I don't despise it. I recognize, you know, that it's very well done of its kind. I guess I just don't happen to like its kind very much anymore. And I also recognize, to be fair, that many people will probably prefer this early version, that many people may find the new one rather stark and spare emotionally. But this variation, number 25, represents everything that I mistrust in the early version that I made of the Goldberg. It wears its heart in its sleeve. It seems to say, please take note, this is tragedy. You know, it doesn't have the dignity to bear its suffering with a hint of quiet resignation.
And the new version does.
Well, I'm prejudiced, but I think it does, yeah.
Well, we're approaching a cadence, so why don't we use that excuse to switch over to the new version?
It couldn't come too soon for me.
And there you have it, Glenn Gould and one of our guests today, Tim Page, from back in 1982, I think that was, Tim?
It was 1982. I'd like to say a little bit about that interview, if I might.
Sure.
It was the strangest thing I ever did. I'd been talking with Glenn over the phone for about 2 years at that point. And we'd become, I have to say, we'd become pretty good friends. And when he was going to bring out this new recording, he sent me a demo disc, as they called them then, of the test pressing of the recording, and he asked me to listen to it, and I listened to it, and I gave him my feedback, And I said, you know, well, this is interesting, this is interesting. And then he said that he wanted to do a radio program with me. But it couldn't be the two of us just talking. It had to be, he would take down all my opinions and then write a sort of dialogue in which Tim Page was asked to play an actor playing Tim Page. I was not yet a full-time journalist. Actually, I was best known as a radio host then, so I agreed to do it. But I wish my acting were better. I mean, I say nothing in the interview that I don't mean, but it was entirely scripted by Glenn from my opinions and from our phone conversations. So there are some moments which are supposed to be funny which aren't, and right. There are moments where I'm supposed to be.
Listening back to that, I just think it's a combination of actually very funny because you can tell that it's scripted, but there is a lot of very interesting information there, and Gould sounds like he's being candid.
Yeah, he does, and I try to sound like I'm being candid, but it was also recorded at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm a notorious early bird, so I was just pinching myself to try to stay awake. I got my wonderful reward from it, though. At the end of the interview, I wasn't going to say anything like, could you play something, but he sat down and he started playing at the piano in the studio. So I think I'm one of the youngest people to have ever heard him play live, as he quit playing the piano almost 50 years ago in concert, but I got to hear him for about a half hour that night, and I wish I could remember it better, but it was about 6 a.m., and I was dying.
Anastasia, we have another question from the chat room.
Ted Temple is asking, what analyses, and maybe this would be a good question for Anne, what analyses would you recommend for someone who wants to more learn about the intricacies of each of the Goldbergs' 30 variations?
Whoa.
There's so much that's been written about the Goldbergs. I think Tim might be more familiar with the scholarly literature than I am. My first instinct is always to listen as much as you can to as many different recordings as you can, which is what helps the analysis to spring out. The way it's put together becomes very evident if you compare Simona Dinnerstein, for example, and early Glenn Gould, and Wanda Landowska on the harpsichord back
in the 30s.
Andras Schiff now, or Pariah did a very highly acclaimed recording. But I know that you're asking about things to read, and that's not really answering that question.
Well, I would agree with Anne, though, that the main thing is to listen, because most of the actual technical writing about the Goldbergs tends to be on a sort of very high academic level. And I think the main thing is really to feel this music. I think it was the complications in the music that kept people away from it for a long period of time. And it's interesting, you know, when Gould's second recording came out that very year, what was then CBS Masterworks released a 2 LP, as it was then, version on harpsichord by Rosalind Turek, and that was 80 minutes. Every single repeat.
I should just toot our own horn here a little bit. We've been celebrating the Goldbergs all week, and Jeremy Dink, who has not yet recorded the Goldberg Variations, who is thinking seriously about it at some point, he's been writing about the Goldberg Variations on our website, on Deceptive Cadence, NPR's classical music blog, and he has a wonderfully warped mind sometimes, and I would recommend those in the chat room who haven't taken the time to read his essays, one of which is called Why I Hate the Goldbergs, and another which is called Hannibal Lecter's Guide to the Goldbergs. Some very insightful and funny writing about them.
But and not just writing, but he did some videos for us of going through some of the variations.
Absolutely.
Which are less crazy funny, but very, very insightful and well worth your time.
And you get to see Jeremy Dink's apartment because we popped in there and recorded him at his piano. But let's get back to Mr. Glenn Gould. We have the second half of Bach's Goldberg Variations now, 16 through 30, plus the Return of the Aria, and we'll all come back on the flip side and talk some more about them. ¶¶ We've been exploring Bach's Goldberg Variations all week here at NPR Music, and we've just heard the second half of the Goldberg Variations with Glenn Gould and his iconic 1955 recording. I'm Tom Huizenga, along with Anastasia Silkis, Anne Majette, classical music critic of the Washington Post, and author and USC professor Tim Page, a former friend of Glenn Gould's. And safe to say, no one really plays Bach like that. I'm just wondering, do we hear that in players today? What's the 1955 Goldberg legacy?
Well, the legacy is that everybody will spend the rest of history trying to jump over it. I think it's safe to say that any time the Goldbergs are written about or reviewed, the name of Gould is going to be mentioned in that article or review somewhere. As Anastasia intimated, the entire early music movement, or more accurately, the historically informed performance movement, is certainly informed and in the spirit of what Gould did in 55, trying to reclaim this once arcane musical terrain and reinject it with life, fun, hipness. I think also it's influenced our liking of sets and completeness, the idea that we want to hear all of the Beethoven sonatas, all of the Goldbergs before, you know, certainly before the 20th century, the idea of doing them all together wasn't the kind of thing it is now. And you hear that very often from with people in different repertories, Beethoven symphonies or whatever. And finally, the Goldbergs themselves are now presented or are now exist for pianists as a hurdle they want to scale.
It's almost a rite of passage.
Absolutely.
Tim, what do you think about the Gould legacy and the Goldbergs?
It's a wonderful recording. It's still surprising and beautiful and amazingly fresh, as if it were out of a time capsule. I think the important thing about Gould's legacy, though, is if you really want to be true to the spirit of Glenn Gould, that does not mean aping Glenn Gould. I sometimes hear people who do sort of an ersatz version of Glenn when they're playing, and that's exactly the wrong message to take with them. I think I'm going to be very sage-like and maybe a little fatuous here, but I'm going to say that really what people should do is sort of find their inner Glenn rather than try to be like him, because he was above all an individual, and I think that trying to imitate an individual is to, especially such a charismatic and unusual individual, is to misunderstand what he stood for.
Anastasia, we've had a lot of interesting comments in the chat room.
We have, and a bunch of questions about preparation. And one of them actually came from one of our colleagues, Brian McCreath, up at Classical New England in Boston, wants to know how many takes this recording was made with, if you happen to know, Tim.
I sort of do. There were not that many long takes. Some of the variations were pretty much done all at once. Occasionally, what would happen would be Glenn would start one of the variations, then stop it. One of my great regrets is that the engineers turned off the tape recorder whenever he stopped, so we hear almost no in-studio chatter, except at the very end where he does this kind of marvelous quodlibet based on God Save the Queen and the Star-Spangled Banner and makes jokes with the people in the studio. I just wish they'd kept the darn tape recorder going the whole time in between, because it's really funny, and you get a huge sense of Glenn's sense of humor. And we put together sort of a 15-minute track of outtakes for the original Goldberg Variations, when the 55 version, when we brought out the set A State of Wonder.
There's the two Glenn Gould recordings a couple of decades apart, and maybe for those who don't really know about the later recording from 1981, maybe Tim, you can just describe how it differs, and maybe why do you think Glenn came to that particular approach a couple decades after his first recording?
Well, there are, in fact, four different Goldberg variations that Glenn recorded. He recorded one for the CBC in 1954. He recorded the famous one, which we just heard, in 55. He recorded one at the Salzburg Festival in 59, but that was a live performance. I think the reason he came back to it was he wanted to examine, I think, its darker moments. This version has no repeats, for instance, And in the later version, he took some repeats, not all by any means, but certainly some of the repeats. And the whole mood is darker and more introspective. I mean, this is just an explosion of joy. But there's a tragic dimension to the Goldbergs that he explores, I think, more convincingly in the later version. I mean, it's the difference between youth and middle age, although I'm not, you know, saying that middle-aged people can't be joyous too, because in some ways I find it a more pleasant, you know, situation than youth. But there is a buoyancy to youth, a sort of immortality to youth that I think you hear on that recording, on the first recording.
You know, what's interesting is that we put up a little highly scientific poll up on Facebook, and maybe Anastasia, you could explain what we did and the results of it.
I put up a whole bunch of recordings saying, which is your favorite, and I included the Goldberg 55, the Goldberg 81, Rosalind Turek. Let's see, who else do I put up? Wanda Landowska, Richard Egar, sort of across the spectrum and across a big chronological span too, and resoundingly, the Gould 81 recording was by far like three times over the favorite, which I thought was
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So it kind of makes you wonder whether the recording we just listened to, so iconic and so popular in its day and throughout the decades, has it overstayed its welcome, Anne?
Well, perhaps it's the fate of iconic recordings that aficionados want to know better. Aficionados will say, well, the 55 is all very well, but we really prefer the 81.
We did have a number of people say, well, really, it's all about the 59.
Well, the funny thing is, it has to be remembered that for 25 years, more than 25 years, we only had the 55, and we were pretty darned happy with it.
Right.
That's true. We have just a few more minutes left, and Anastasia, maybe we can take one or two quick questions from the chat room.
Sure. Tom Chittum, along the lines of what Brian asked earlier, wants to know, Tim, do you have any idea how long he prepared for recording the 55 version? I mean, of course, he had made such a big splash just a few months earlier in recital, but do you have a sense of the time spanning it took with the idea of recording in mind?
Well, he had recorded it for the CBC the preceding year, so it had been, quote-unquote, in his fingers for a while. When did he start studying it? I don't really know. I just don't. But he was already playing a lot of Bach, and my guess would be he probably started playing it in his teens.
And this is a Gould question again, and not a Goldberg question, but Jason McCool is asking us, what does Tim make of Gould's fascination with Petula Clark's music? Do you think his analyses were genuine or tongue-in-cheek?
I think Glenn, like many of us, had a great fondness for the music that he heard when he was growing up. It should be remembered that Petula Clark in England and much of Canada was very much sort of an outpost of England at that point, and especially the CBC. Shared that fascination with Petula Clark, which really didn't hit the U.S. so much until she had that spectacular hit with Downtown about 1965. But Glenn probably grew up listening to her because she was making records when she was 12, 13, 14. And I think he did have a fondness for her. I think he also saw her as sort of the guardian of the old tradition of the music hall, vaudeville, classic song structure, and Glenn, who was something of a conservative when it came to some of his musical tastes, I think saw her as sort of a reaction to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and the self-described blue nose Puritan in him preferred that to the wild and kind of unruly music that was starting to dominate the airwaves.
Okay, we're just about out of time. Any last thoughts from anybody, Anne, after hearing the recording again?
Well, I was thinking that it's probably impossible today to make a recording that iconic. There are so many recordings now. It's hard for any one performer, however distinct and special his or her vision, to be heard the way it was possible to be heard in 1955.
Mm.
I would like to say that Glenn Gould would totally approve of what we did today. And one of, I think, the great disasters, among many of the disasters of his death at the age of 50, was the fact that he never got to work with the internet. I could see Glenn Gould just loving the internet, deciding he wanted to record one thing one day, doing it himself, putting it out on his own website, continuing his you know, fondness for seclusion and aloneness, but still communicating with the world through technology. And I think he would have just loved it. I think there would have been so many Glenn Gould recordings. He would have moved all the big record companies out of the picture entirely, and been the ultimate do-it-yourselfer.
Oh, I think that's so true. And I think, you can just imagine him surfing away to his heart's content. I think we should leave it there. A great image of Glenn at his computer. I'd like to thank our guest today, Anne Majette, who has her own blog, Classical Beat, at thewashingtonpost.com. Anne, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thanks for having me.
And Tim Page, Anne's predecessor at the Washington Post, where he won a Pulitzer for his criticism there. He's a professor of journalism and music at USC. Tim Page, always nice to talk to you.
Always a pleasure to talk with all of you. Have a great day.
And Anastasia Silkis, my cohort at NPR's classical music blog, Deceptive Cadence. Thanks, Anastasia.
A pleasure. Thanks for putting this together, Tom.
All right. I think it's back to work for us now, unfortunately. And thanks, everyone in the chat room today and asking questions and listening to this amazing recording. Still sounding pretty good after all of these years, I must say. Don't forget to check out our Goldberg coverage on Deceptive Cadence this week. Essays, performances, videos by Jeremy Denk, Leif Ove Andsnes, Andreas Steyer, and lists of great Goldberg recordings, even a Goldberg puzzler. And thanks, everyone, for the listening party today. Hope you are prepared to have a great weekend. Tom Heisinger here. It's NPR Music. And we leave you with a little bit of Glenn Gould's 1981 recording of the aria from the Goldberg Variations.